Thank you for tuning in for the February 2nd podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals, Neurology, Neurology Genetics, Neurology, Neuroimmunology and Inflammation, and Neurology Clinical Practice. This week's feature interview focuses on a study that looks at how structural network abnormalities relate to outcomes after epilepsy surgery. In our What's Trending segment, you'll hear the first installment of our four-part series, Update in Epilepsy.
Hi, this is Hallie Alexander from Wake Forest University. Today I'm speaking with Nishant Sinha from Newcastle University regarding the recent article in Neurology titled Structural Brain Network Abnormalities and the Probability of Seizure Recurrence After Epilepsy Surgery. So Nishant, this is really an exciting study because I think it has the potential to add a lot to the surgical management of epilepsy patients. So tell us, where are we at right now in our current clinical practice in terms of our ability to predict outcomes in epilepsy surgery? And then fill us in on what does your study add to the field?
Yeah, hi, Hallie. So the current clinical state of the art predicting surgical outcomes in epilepsy mainly relies on the clinical variables, such as the demographic information, historical data, seizure semiology, and routine radiological examination. But despite this, nearly 40% of the patients are not seizure-free after the surgery in the short term. And in the long term, the relapse rate is even higher. So we designed our study based on a very simple intuition. Whether a patient is seizure-free after the surgery or not would not just depend on how the brain was before the surgery, but also on the surgery itself, and specifically how the brain network would be impacted due to surgery.
Excellent. Yeah. So your study then is not just relying on clinical variables, but you're actually taking into account the specific planned surgery that's going to be done on the patient, which is something that we currently don't have the ability to do. So this is really exciting.
Yeah.
So if you could just tell us in very kind of broad and basic terms to start, what did you do in this study? And then what was your main finding?
Yeah, sure. So we retrospectively examined both the routine clinical data and structural brain connectome data of 51 drug-resistant epilepsy patients. So for each patient, we quantified what brain tissue was dissected by comparing the pre- and the post-surgical MRI. In a prospective application where a patient is being considered for surgery, one can simply draw the plan for an intended resection on a pre-surgical MRI before carrying out the actual surgical procedure. This allowed us to estimate a network which is expected to remain after the surgery. So we then compared the brain network of each individual with how the brain network appears in a population of healthy subjects. This way, we determine how abnormal the brain network of a patient is. But more importantly, because we included the information of surgery in our analysis, we were able to determine how much abnormality in the brain connectome is expected to remain after the surgery. So we found that these abnormalities were not just limited to the temporal lobe, but in many patients, the abnormalities extended well beyond the temporal lobe, even to the contralateral hemisphere. And those patients who had more abnormality remaining after the surgery were not seizure-free. And even if they were seizure-free in the first year after the surgery, they relapsed upon follow-up at later years. So there is a clear association between the abnormalities remaining after epilepsy surgery and the chances of seizure freedom.
And that makes sense, but this is the first time we've really been able to have the data, I guess, to confirm that. So you basically took the patient's MRI and used computer software to examine how abnormal it is in terms of network abnormalities, which you can tell us about here in a little bit. But then basically what was really innovative here is that you took the planned surgery into account and drew out on the MRI what was planned to be left after the epilepsy surgery and then was able to quantify how abnormal those nodes were. And then what you found was that that actually correlated. So the more abnormalities that were left over after surgery, the less chance of seizure freedom. Did I summarize that correctly?
Yeah. So we compared the brain network of the patients with the population of healthy subjects to compute the abnormality. We used the computer software to exactly locate what tissue was resected in the patients. And then, yes, we summarized it, right? What abnormalities remained after the surgery was associated with the surgical outcomes.
So this really is some individualized medicine here in terms of predicting, you know, specifically for that patient, for their brain, and then for their specific surgery. So now, could you tell us more about how machine learning was used in this study?
Yeah, sure. So machine learning allows us to quantify how the inferences we have drawn about the association between seizure outcome and brain network abnormalities would generalize on new, previously unseen data. So we first characterize each patient based on their clinical attributes and their brain network abnormalities before the surgery and expected to remain after the surgery. Then we pretended to not have the data for some patients, and we ran the entire analysis afresh with the remaining data, essentially training a robust machine learning algorithm to predict surgical outcomes. So for each patient for which we pretended to not have the data off, we estimated their probability or likelihood of seizure relapse from the cross-validated machine learning model. So this is a sort of pseudo-prospective analysis. In simple terms, we found that when we add the brain network abnormality information to the routine clinical data, we were able to assign a number for every patient, which could not just tell whether a patient will be seizure-free or not in binary terms, but it could also indicate their risk on a scale of 0 to 1. That is how confident we are about a patient being seizure-free or not seizure-free after the surgery.
Well, that really adds a lot to what we're currently able to do because, you know, right now all we have is the data kind of from all comers. We can say in general, you know, we think you might have this percent of chance that you'll be seizure-free after surgery, but this is definitely a lot more specific. So now your study was done specifically on temporal lobe epilepsy patients who undergo a very standard surgery, the anterior temporal lobectomy. But can this information be applied to other types of epilepsy, for example, our non-lesional extratemporal epilepsy patients? Because these are really the cases where we have an even greater uncertainty in our ability to predict seizure freedom after epilepsy surgery.
Yes, that is a very good point, Hallie, and thank you for bringing this up. Yes, the uncertainty about post-surgery seizure outcome in non-lesional and extratemporal lobe epilepsies are even greater. And our initial investigation suggests encouraging results for these patients. So even though the patients we have included in our study are only TLE, our analysis is rather on the whole brain. And we find abnormalities, not just in the temporal lobe, but extending well beyond the temporal lobe. We therefore suspect that in non-lesional and extratemporal patients, the association between abnormalities and seizure freedom may hold. In either case, our approach to include the knowledge of surgery is the key here, regardless of where the surgery is performed on.
So then how do you imagine this being applied to like the everyday clinical care of our epilepsy patients in the future?
Yeah, so during the pre-surgical evaluation, the surgery plan for a patient is typically discussed through a multidisciplinary team meeting. We hope that we would be able to complement their decision-making by providing an estimate of how likely it is for a patient to have seizure recurrence for the surgery that is being planned. Our method is completely non-invasive, and we hope to be able to compute these estimates quickly through an easy-to-use software tool.
Yeah, that's excellent. So we always talk about kind of looking at the risk-benefit ratio when we're talking about epilepsy surgery, since it is brain surgery. And so basically your software and calculations could really give us a more specific benefit number. And then we also will have to take, you know, whatever risks into account that are necessary for that specific patient.
Yes, precisely. Yeah.
Well, that's so exciting. Well, I look forward to the day when this technology becomes incorporated into our standard care so that we can better evaluate the risk-benefit ratio for our epilepsy patients. Our listeners can find the full text of the article in this week's issue of the Neurology Journal. And again, the article is titled Structural Brain Network Abnormalities and the Probability of Seizure Recurrence After Epilepsy Surgery. Thank you, Nishant, for sharing this with us today.
Thank you, Hallie. My pleasure to be with you.
Hey, everyone. This is Fabio Nascimento with the Neurology Podcast, bringing you our what's trending in the diagnosis and management of different seizures and epilepsies. Today, we have the honor of interviewing Elizabeth Teal from the Massachusetts General Hospital. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you very much, Fabio.
So let's get it started. Let's focus on epileptic spasms first. My first question for you would be, how do they look like?
Wow, that's a really good question. And it's actually infantile spasms are the reason I became a pediatric epileptologist. When babies start having spasms, and typically they start around 4 to 6 months of age, parents will notice clusters of episodes during which the baby either has a quick extension or flexion. And the flexion is what led to the other term for this, Salaam attacks. Basically, we'll typically, at sleep-wake interfaces, have a cluster of these very quick movements. And the parents, even new parents that don't have a lot of experience around young babies and children, will recognize that this looks abnormal. Often when they start, the baby also has a change in personality and may go from being a very social, happy, interactive baby to appearing very apathetic. So sometimes even before the onset of the spasms, the parents note this behavioral change in their child.
When we make the diagnosis or suspect epileptic spasms, Elizabeth, what investigations need to happen for those kids?
Definitely an EEG. I think that's the most important thing. Babies can have weird movements. It's a little unusual to have very stereotyped paroxysmal clusters of movements, but they could. And so an EEG really is needed. Interictally, we frequently look for the pattern of hypsarrhythmia, which, as you know, is very abnormal EEG, very high amplitude, very chaotic background, and multifocal epileptiform discharges. So that's the classic EEG pattern we think of when we think of infantile spasms, but sometimes we don't see that. Many children with tuberous sclerosis complex never have classic hypsarrhythmia. Lysencephaly often doesn't. Aicardi syndrome often doesn't. And these syndromes frequently have infantile spasms associated with them. So what we do if the interictal EEG doesn't help lead to is the spasms or not, it's very important to do video EEG monitoring in these babies to actually capture episodes. And what you look for ictally is a relatively high amplitude, slow wave, followed by an electrodecrement. And that can also help lead to the diagnosis of spasms.
So does that mean that we start off with a routine EEG, an outpatient routine EEG, and if that doesn't help, we bring them into the hospital to do a video EEG for a prolonged period of time?
Yes, and kind of the diagnosis of spasms needs to be made as soon as possible. So this is the setting where parents would basically either call the pediatrician, see the pediatrician, and I really think the baby should then be evaluated in an emergency room that has the capability of doing an EEG. We and others have done a lot of research looking at the outcomes of infantile spasms, and the duration or length of time from onset to effective treatment is a variable. So it's really important to diagnose spasms as quickly as possible so they can be treated effectively as quickly as possible.
That's super helpful to know. And now more in terms of etiology, and you mentioned some of the diseases that are associated with epileptic spasms. Knowing the cause changes management overall and prognosis, or not as much?
Knowing the cause in some situations does matter. For instance, tuberous sclerosis is a common cause of spasms. About a third of babies with tuberous sclerosis complex will develop infantile spasms. And we know of the treatments available that for this population, particularly vigabatrin has been shown numerous times to be more effective than steroid treatment. So if you know the baby has TS, and often that can be determined by a clinical examination and brain imaging after the diagnosis of spasms, then really vigabatrin should be used first line. For other etiologies, I think steroids overall, ACTH or oral steroids continue to be maybe superior to vigabatrin. But in the past couple of years, there's really been a trend to consider combination therapy at onset with vigabatrin and with a steroid. And I think the UCAS trials have suggested that that could improve not only efficacy of treatment, but outcomes.
Since we're talking about treatment now, can you talk about the options we have? And you mentioned some of them. From a cost-conscious point of view, we know that there's a dramatic range in pricing of treatments here. And does that kind of play a role when you're picking those therapies?
I think the longest used treatment for infantile spasms is ACTH, which has been used for decades, only FDA approved this past decade, but has been used. Vigabatrin, as you know, is FDA approved now several years ago. So we have two FDA approved treatments. As you said, the price of ACTH increased significantly several years ago. And so there's been increasing use of oral steroids, prednisolone and prednisone. Unfortunately, there's never been a head-to-head comparison trial between prednisolone and ACTH. So I think many of us feel that until proven otherwise, ACTH is probably the preferred treatment, even with the cost. So I think that what we take into account when we treat babies with spasms is what would be the most effective treatment, because we know that treating the spasms will give the child the best possible chance for a good outcome.
And how do these kids do as they grow older? What's the prognosis? And also, if you can touch on, how do you approach this diagnosis with the parents?
So the prognosis of infantile spasms, as you know, probably the majority of babies who do develop infantile spasms have some degree of cognitive impairment and outcome variable. But some kids can have a good outcome. Take, for instance, tuberous sclerosis complex. Although a third of children with TSC will develop infantile spasms, actually a third of those will have a normal cognitive outcome. And we don't really understand what leads to the differences in outcome. Etiology obviously can play a role. You know, babies with Down syndrome can develop infantile spasms, babies with lysencephaly, babies with hypoxic ischemic injury. So I think it's probably the underlying etiology as well as how easily the spasms are controlled and treated. When treating spasms, as you know, it's not only cessation of the spasms we want to see or the treatment endpoint, but it's also a marked improvement in the EEG. So all of those things are important. When we discuss this with the parents, I think it's important for the parent to know that this is an epilepsy that can be associated with a relatively poor/poor prognosis with regard to cognitive outcomes. But it's also important to give the family some degree of hope, since some children who develop infantile spasms do well. One of my kids who had very, very tough to treat infantile spasms, I think it took us maybe 2 to 3 years to really get his spasms controlled when he was a baby, is now a freshman in college in an engineering program, in a program adapted for kids with learning disabilities, but still he's in college after having very tough to treat infantile spasms.
Thank you, Elizabeth. This is super helpful. Now switching gears to simple febrile seizures. Can you tell us what it takes for you to be comfortable attributing the febrile seizure to the simple category?
That also is a really good question, because as you know, many children will have their first seizure occur in the setting of fever. So if a young child has a first seizure in the setting of fever, how do we know it's a simple febrile seizure versus a first seizure provoked by fever? Take, for instance, children with Dravet who will have their first seizure in the setting of a fever. I think to feel comfortable that it's a simple febrile seizure, what is really helpful is a strong family history of febrile seizures. Parents have them, siblings have them, et cetera. In an otherwise normal, healthy child with the seizure occurring often as the temperature quickly goes up, and that after the seizure is over, the child's exam is normal, relatively normal. Sometimes in the setting of strong family history, this is a perfect situation for febrile seizure. We may not get an initial EEG. But if there's any question, either, again, not a strong family history, any lateralization of the seizure, any question of the child's development or examination being normal, I think we would typically get an EEG to try and help determine, are there epileptiform features, which might make you think that this was not a simple febrile seizure, and help direct counseling the family and further management.
And you mentioned that an EEG might not be indicated in those circumstances, depending on how comfortable you are with the febrile seizure being simple or complex. What about a head scan, blood work, even a lumbar puncture? Are those needed when you're more comfortable that it is a simple febrile seizure, or not really?
I think it depends on the clinical situation and the appearance of the child. If the child appears ill or encephalopathic after a seizure, then sure, you'd think about doing other evaluations to determine if there's an underlying infectious process that could warrant more significant treatment, like a meningitis, et cetera. But if the child has, in the setting of family history, fever, brief tonic-clonic seizure, a quick recovery, could be postictal for a period of time, and then a normal neurological examination, nothing lateralizing, nothing concerning, I don't think imaging, blood work, or LP needs to be performed.
And do you treat those kids with benzos or even lowering the temperature, or do you just monitor them, make sure they're fine, and send them home?
I think after the first seizure, children are typically evaluated in an emergency room. I guess unless the family is like very knowledgeable about febrile seizures, has been there, done that with other kids. What we usually do pediatricians, because these kids are often not seen by neurologists after a first febrile seizure. Pediatricians usually advise parents to alternate Tylenol and ibuprofen, kind of depending on the child's age, to help keep the fever spikes from going up during a febrile illness. Years ago, there was a debate that children with frequent febrile seizures, should you give them benzodiazepines when they have a febrile illness? And I think that most of us feel no, it's not uncommon for children to have febrile illnesses and you'd be giving a lot of benzodiazepines. But particularly for children that have frequent febrile seizures and have had prolonged febrile seizures, I think it's probably a really good idea for the family to have a rescue medication available in case they were to have a seizure that went on several minutes.
And what do you think about recommending or not recommending vaccinations for kids with febrile seizures? Because we know that some of the vaccines can cause fever. And if they're prone to having seizures, then they'll have breakthrough, if you will, seizures. So what do you tell the parents?
So I'm a big proponent of vaccines. So I think the kids definitely should get vaccines. It is true, many vaccines would provoke a fever. So what we do in that situation, and actually many of our children with epilepsy in whom fever is a trigger for their seizures, is we recommend giving ibuprofen and acetaminophen around the time of vaccines, just as they would during a febrile illness.
And when you're talking to the parents and they ask, you know, what's the likelihood of my kid having epilepsy in the future? What do you tell them?
We tell them typically that febrile seizures occur in up to 5% of children. And, you know, epilepsy in childhood is like maybe 1.5 to 2%. So the chance of them develop epilepsy is quite low. I think it might be more of a red flag if there is no family history of febrile seizures, or if there is any lateralization or quote unquote a complex febrile seizure. Then we have the discussion that we believe this is likely a febrile seizure, but there is also the possibility that this is a first seizure being provoked by fever.
That's interesting. And if your patient continues to have simple febrile seizures, do you ever consider starting an anti-seizure medication?
If we believe that they are simple febrile seizures, no. But I think if I had a child that maybe after a first febrile seizure family history, we did not get an EEG, I think if that child went on to have a few other febrile seizures, it would be very reasonable to get an EEG to make sure that you're not missing a child who has an underlying epilepsy with the initial seizures being provoked by fever. I think before the increased awareness of Dravet syndrome, I'd be willing to bet that a lot of those children initially, their first seizures were called febrile seizures. And it's only when they went into the second year of life and developed the other seizure types did we realize, well, maybe these weren't simple febrile seizures. So I think our increased understanding and awareness of these epilepsies and the developmental encephalopathies that have onset, you know, the first, second, third year of life is really helping us kind of, but it still can be difficult with that first seizure to say, aha, this is definitely a simple febrile seizure, or to say, no, I think this might be something else. Again, the exam, the family history are important factors to help us trying to differentiate those.
This has been a phenomenal discussion. Thank you so much, Elizabeth. We all appreciate the extraordinary teaching. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have today. Next week, we'll discuss genetic generalized epilepsies and self-limited epilepsy with centrotemporal spikes. Thanks very much for listening to the Neurology Podcast, What's Trending in Epilepsy, and see you next week.
Thank you again for listening and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.